I'm Indy Neidell, and this is the Great War Podcast, which is, of course, the podcast connected to the Great War YouTube channel that covers the First World War. And I am in Istanbul, in Turkey, since we've been filming the Great War at a bunch of different Gallipoli locations. And we have a special guest with us today that, as long as we were in Turkey, we had to meet. Now, you might hear some background noise. That's because it's Istanbul, and there are cars and music and things like that in the background. Just ignore it and listen to the sound of our beautiful voices. So, with me today is Aylin Önetan. Aylin, could you say hi to everybody out there in podcast land?
Hi, hello.
Now, could you tell people a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Well, I'm a food writer, a food columnist, and a food researcher. But originally, I'm an architect trained in the conservation of historic monuments. So I'm writing for Hürriyet Daily News, and I'm also attending food symposiums wherever in the world on food researches. So I'm both a researcher, but not academic, but also a journalist.
And you are relevant to us because you have written stuff about food, the food that the troops ate, and the food situation in certain situations during the First World War.
Yes, I had this idea of making a research on the food in the trenches in Gallipoli War. First, I wrote, because in my columns, I follow the calendar. So I sometimes write about spring rituals, or sometimes what is in the season, like artichokes or eggplants, or sometimes I follow a certain date. And I was writing for the Anzac Day, and I said that there's the Anzac biscuit, so I should maybe write something about it. But the more I read, the more the topic drew myself into it, because it was very interesting. And I noticed that there are so many interesting knowledge, especially on the Anzac side, but not much on the Turkish side.
Right.
But then, of course, if you really go into the topic, you can find many clues. So it can be letters, it can be some notes, it can be the findings in the trenches, like the remains of the cans, or even some beer bottles, shards of beer bottles, or it could be the official documents about the food provisions, and it could be also some notes on how food was carried from one place to another. So it can be anything. Knowledge or documents can come from many different areas. My dream is to further this study and make a day-to-day investigation on the site about also the wild plants available, the edible wild greens and everything, to see the conditions on the site. But this is only a dream now.
Well, I read your paper on the food at Gallipoli, and there was a lot of stuff that was really fascinating. For instance, the Turkish food industry, or the Ottoman food industry, sorry, hadn't really developed. There were only like the production facilities in Izmir and Istanbul. You weren't making canned food all over the country like many of the other nations fighting the war were.
Yeah, when I noticed that the Anzac side, the British allies had everything canned, the bully beef, jam in cans, and even evaporated milk, condensed milk in cans. I said to myself, why did not the Turkish side have any cans? And I noticed that the only canning factory in Istanbul was newly established, and there was another one in Izmir. So we could not talk about an industrial food development in Turkey. So they had to have everything from scratch, or it had to be, more natural food, like dried food, or maybe dried dried fruits and nuts, but not canned food.
Right.
And this was a blessing in a way, because for the other side, the canned food proved to be a curse.
Because it's so salty, it's so sugary, it makes you thirsty. You have to bring water from very other countries, you know.
Yeah, so. They suffered a lot from the lack of fresh water. So very salty food, very dry food like the Anzac biscuits.
Yeah. I've never tried one of those. I mean
the true one. Yeah,
but I've read about them, you know, for so many years, of course, studying the war, and I've never actually gotten hold of one to actually try what it was like. You wrote that they apparently liked the marmalade, but the biscuits were terrible, right?
Yeah, they were all very dry. I mean, you need a lot of water to overcome this kind of food. And then the other horrible thing was when you open a can of bully beef or fruit jam, then it attracts the flies. So there were this horrible problem of flies all over because of the corpses and because the sanitary, you don't have proper toilets in many times.
We actually mentioned in the show that when Charles Monroe took control of the Allied troops in October of 1915 and did his, you know, looking around, of the roughly 100,000 troops he had there, he estimated that 50,000 of them were unfit for duty because of illness. That's half because of this, you know.
That's horrible. So in a way, I think the food contributed to this. I mean, they had diarrhea. They had also food related illnesses as well. Whereas the Turkish side, I mean, these kids knew their land because foraging wild greens is a big habit in Anatolia.
It's like a tradition, right?
Yes, it's a tradition since the hunters and gatherers.
That's great.
It's a big tradition. And children always go, either male or female children, go along with their mothers to forage greens. And they know what to pick and eat. So what happens is probably these kids knew their land and knew what to eat from the land. Whereas if you come from New Zealand or Australia, it's like the other side of the planet. So if you think about the globe, if you stick the polar opposite of Turkey is New Zealand.
It is.
So it is just like the other side of the planet. Yeah. And it's, of course, also the plants are completely different. If you go to Australia today or New Zealand, you wouldn't know which wild green to forage to eat. I mean, it can be poisonous.
And you had poisonous things. You had variants of the belladonna and nightshade family and stuff.
Yes.
I think that's amazing that they were able to, I think that's amazing that they had this local and traditional knowledge. And other than the foraging, which I guess can't supply all of your diet because you're talking of tens of thousands of men, were they getting foods from like local produce, or was it a lot of it coming from further away?
Well, many of the farmers they got organized in such a way that they were sending their food to the military and it was carried to the trenches.
Okay.
So the military was buying stuff from the farmers.
Yeah.
Or even from Istanbul, and they were trying to get the food to the trenches as far as possible.
Sure.
There were cases that this chain was broken, or at times, I would say. But mostly they were getting their food like rice or beans or whatever, but they were cooking from scratch.
How did it work with the field kitchens then? Were the kitchens near the front lines where they could be shot at?
The front lines, they couldn't cook, but they tried to carry the fresh water and the cooked food to the front trenches from the back trenches or back whatever the kitchens, the field kitchens.
Right.
But there were field kitchens established. So they were trying to have the food to the front lines from the field kitchens from the backside. But of course, they had some, you know, foods in their pockets, like fruits and nuts, dried fruits, and or peximet, which is the dried, there's the whatever, the twice cooked bread slices, I would say, like biscotti.
That last a long time.
Yeah, that lasts a long time. So this is one of my newspaper pieces were Anzac biscuits versus peximet.
Which would you rather have?
I don't know. I never tasted a real Anzac biscuit. Okay. It could be healthy because it's made with oats, so it can be...
But you have tasted...
peximet. Yeah, always still have it.
Is it good?
No, it's pretty good, yeah. Imagine like a dried bread.
And would they eat it just by itself or with the fruit or with something spread on it?
No, just by itself.
Okay. Oh, okay, that's interesting. We got to try that one day. I'm saying that to Flo, everybody out there. Flo is with me here.
They were always trying to get a soup also in the field kitchens, which is very healthy, I guess.
Well, how successful were they during the, whatever, 9 months or 8 months of the Gallipoli campaign? How successful were they at actually keeping everyone reasonably well fed compared to the Allies?
Well, I think it was pretty successful. There are stories like, you know, they had only a raisin, compote, okay. and another raisin compote for lunch, and only just a small bowl. They didn't have any food. But that's not correct. This is overly romanticizing the poor conditions of the war. One commander said later in his... like autobiography, that I am so happy because I have never let my soldiers go hungry. Of course, there are times. It's such a dramatic war that there are times that people had problem with the soldiers had problem with also the food, sure. But I think it was not as dramatic as the other side.
And how often would they get like what you might consider a luxury, like meat?
I think at the beginning it was they could get, but meat was problematic towards the end.
You wouldn't get it. Would you get it every week or every few days, or if you were going to go on an offensive or something? Or?
Well, I don't have this mapping of the... I think one should have a mapping of the site, the trenches, and also by calendar. I don't know, maybe it could be done through a computer program or something.
Oh, yeah.
I really don't know that. You know, you have to have... Because you can get sometimes good food up to front trenches, and sometimes not. It depends also the time of the year, because it was almost for a year. So there are summer months, winter months.
We did a bizarre little special a few years ago on the channel where we cooked Makinochi stew, which was a rough recipe that changed, that was served on the Western Front that the Allied soldiers would eat, and it's very iconic. For World War I buffs on the Allied side to think this is what we ate. And Julian, our sound guy, actually had a project where he had to make German home food, not army food, but German home food from, was it 1914 and 1918? And the bread soup of 1918 and stuff, which isn't iconic, but you could see the change. Are there things like that, like the bully beef and the Anzac biscuits? Is there anything like that that's a specific food on the Ottoman side, or was it really just a case of you got all this great ecological stuff from the local farmers and did what you could? You didn't have to eat salty canned food. You could forage for things if you knew what they were, and if you didn't, you just have to rely on your comrades. So is there something like that?
Well, they started making like a reenactment, or not exactly, but, you know, creating a menu on the spot for... to commemorate the Gallipoli War. So I think it's a bulgur soup. As I said, there are overly romanticized lack of food, like this raisin compote with just a few raisins in and so on. But we could say that there is like bulgur pilaf or bulgur soup,
yeah,
and raisins.
These were big staples.
Compote. And if they could get rice and meat, they tried to have. Sometimes they had beans, a bean stew.
Okay.
There's nothing as iconic as Anzac biscuits,
okay,
or the dishes that you mentioned.
No.
We don't have this such a menu or dish that this is the...
We had to live on this.
Yeah, we had to live on this, and
this is what you know. Okay. Now, this brings up an interesting point to me. I'm wondering, since the Ottoman Empire was so vast at the time, but didn't have industrial food, how regional was the cuisine back then? Was there something that you associated as Ottoman food? Like, you know, there is, like, the British, you could go anywhere in the British Isles and get fish and chips, you know. You could go to Cornwall, or you could go up to you know, can't you go to Cambridge, you could go up to Scotland and get fish and chips. Was it much more regional because of transportation and no strong food industry, or was there a national cuisine?
Well, Ottoman Empire was such a big geography.
Yeah.
So we can talk about an Ottoman cuisine, but today when we are talking about Ottoman cuisine, we usually refer to the Istanbul Palace kitchen, the food served in the... cooked in the kitchens of the Ottoman Palace. But when we're talking about the Ottoman Palace, it's not just the royal family or the sultan and the family. People working for the palace, they were also served the same food.
Okay.
And the families of the staff of the Topkapı Palace, or
yeah,
later in Dolmabahçe Palace, they were sent food from the palace kitchen. So what was eaten in the palace influenced Istanbul cuisine greatly, because people knew they were served the same food from the palace kitchens.
Okay.
To the families. The food was carried by porters to the families just living outside the court. So this is something very interesting. And there was in the Ottoman system this imaret system. Imaret is like a soup kitchen.
Okay.
Where poor and the needy are served, or anybody can be served food. So these imarets, wherever in the throughout the empire, tried to serve the more or less the same food. So it was, instead of bulgur, which is cracked wheat,
yeah,
it would be more rice pilaf, because it was more, how do you say, belonged to the court,
the
or
court.
Istanbul. You would have more or less the same menu all over. So this Ottoman cuisine, or the Istanbul cuisine, was distributed throughout the empire. So in every region you had the more or less the same food in the imarets, the soup kitchens. But of course, for example, the villagers ate more bulgur when compared to rice, because it was much less costly.
Right.
And second, they cultivated the wheat themselves.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, they have their own bulgur. So we can talk about a general Ottoman cuisine, or a Turkish cuisine now, because now shrunk to the borders where Turkey. But then if you go to the southeast, the local regional cuisine is more similar to that of Syria or Lebanon, because they are very... Or, you know, in the Aegean coast, we can say that the Aegean cuisine, Turkish Aegean cuisine is almost identical with the Greek cuisine. Or if you go to the Balkans in the borders, you can talk about the Thrace region of Turkey is very similar to Bulgarian cuisine or something. So there is a regionality beyond ethnicity and faith. But there's a general idea of the Ottoman cuisine or Turkish cuisine as now. So it's very interesting to study this similarities and the cuisine in general of the Ottoman geography, I would say.
Now, do you plan more historical research in terms of food or gastronomy or anything to do with food from that period in the future, or what does the future hold for you? What are you working on? What do you plan? Where are you going now?
Oh my God, I'm trying to write a book on the history of food in Turkey from Paleolithic times.
That's going to be great.
Till today, including the prospect for the future as well. It's a tough study, and my editor will kill me soon, I think.
When do you think you'll be finished with that we can expect to see that?
He asks the same question.
He called me earlier and he said, listen, you have to ask her.
Okay, it's for Reaction Publications in UK, and it will hopefully be out next year. Oh yes, I did the Gallipoli research. I presented it in a Dublin Gastronomy Symposium. Okay. It was 2 years ago. And the theme was on food and revolution, including also topics on war.
Okay.
So that's why I chose this topic to present at the symposium, which proved to be very interesting. It was very emotional because the Gallipoli war also led to the independence of Ireland. It was very interesting to see the connections.
Okay, that was fantastic. Thank you very much, Aileen Öne-Tan. Would you like to say goodbye to everyone out there in podcast land?
Well, goodbye. Food, I think, is heritage. It's a shared heritage. So it's very interesting. And in every slice of history, food tells us about the people.
Well, it reflects the human condition. It can't help but do that. And that's great. And it's really, really interesting what you're doing. And I really look forward to reading more of your stuff. So thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. I hope everybody out there loved that. And we'll see you next time, won't we, Flo?
Yes.
Okay, bye.